We're back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Even if you're not into architecture, you probably know Frank Lloyd Wright's name. But despite being one of the most famous architects of the 20th century, and despite all of the books written about him and his work, the man himself remains somewhat of a mystery. Even his autobiography was embellished, and historians admit they can never truly verify fact from fiction. Well, one thing that author and journalist Paul Hendrickson thinks has been left out of all the previous accounts of Frank Lloyd Wright is his humanity, the man who was haunted by his buildings and their fates as much as he was made famous for them. Hendrickson's new book, Plagued by Fire, is a sympathetic and perceptive look at Wright that he hopes will change the way people perceive the architect. Hendrickson will be in Milwaukee tonight to talk about the book at Boswell Book Company, but ahead of that, he joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to explain why he took a 7-year deep dive into the life of the famous architect.
I feel I came to him organically, a word that Wright would approve of. I grew up in Kankakee, Illinois, where there were two famous Wright houses, not only in that small town 50 miles below Chicago, but indeed literally on the same street I lived on. We lived 5 blocks north, where the average people of the town lived, our barely middle-class family, but 5 blocks down at the river where the wealthy lived were these two immense Frank Lloyd Wright houses, especially one, the B. Harley Bradley House, 1900, which is in every Frank Lloyd Wright book. It's a seminal house. It's a kind of precursor to all of his prairie work. It's a St. John the Baptist house. And I, as a 9-year-old in 1953, so you can understand something about my age, would sail past that house on my way to the ballpark with my ball glove hooked on my handlebars of my brand new J.C. Higgins 3-speed, which I got for Christmas that year. Something was pulling me in and simultaneously scaring me about the B. Harley Bradley. But because I'm a slow learner, it only took 6.5 decades to loop around and find me as a storytelling project. The truth is, Audrey, I'm not even sure I knew the name Frank Lloyd Wright in 1953. As the years went on and I became a kind of amateur student of architecture, I began to learn more about Frank Lloyd Wright. But until I started this project, I was in no way, shape, or form any kind of Frank Lloyd Wright expert. What I am is a narrative nonfiction writer who gets obsessively hooked into these projects.
Why did you choose to set the tone of the book off with the fire and murders at Taliesin right here in Wisconsin? It's an interesting way to set the stage.
I think that's a great follow-up question to what you asked. When you said riddles wrapped up inside of riddles, triangles drawn inside of squares, which is what I say in the text, that event, the most iconic and savage event in Frank Lloyd Wright's life, takes place on August 15th, 1914, when this black servant in a white serving tunic, supposed to be ladling out the midday soup, goes inexplicably berserk and tries to roast the place to cinders, and with a shingling hatchet destroys 7 of the 9 lives in that building. Wright wasn't there that day. That event, for a century and more, has remained in some ways at the heart of the inexplicability of Frank Lloyd Wright's preposterously complicated, tortured life. That event, which, you know, the most casual student of Wright might know something about, can stand for so many other events, because it is, Audrey, the riddle wrapped inside the square. So I decided as a journalist to try to find out what I could. And I think I went a distance further than most people have ever gone. For one thing, finding out about the black servant who did this. I mean, history has had a hard time getting his name right. It's Julian Carleton. It's been misspelled. It's been misstated. The first 7 words in the Chicago Tribune the next morning were, "A Barbados Negro with a hand axe yesterday." No, he was from our own country. He was from the Deep South. He was from Alabama. in a family of 13 or 15 children whose parents may have been born into slavery. So I, as best I could, went to understand whatever I could about that person. It was as if we always had the deed and none of the life. Did I solve the riddle? No. I only got edges and pieces.
There are indeed a lot of riddles when it comes to Frank Lloyd Wright and his life. You know, what's true, what's not. You admit, along with other historians and other people who have studied and wrote about him, that you never know, even if it's his first primary documents, his own accounts, you don't know what is completely truthful or not. And it's noted that, you know, 72 years as an architect and an egoist, you make sure to point that out. So I'm curious with you and taking a deep dive into this man, do you consider other works about Wright that it's reverencing an egoist? How do you balance that, you know, the weight of the work compared to the weight of the man and his personal character?
Yeah, maybe in one sense we could say that the only thing that counts is the work. The only thing that counts is the built work, the architecture that survives. I hear that. But I feel that there is a deeper way to appreciate that architecture through some understanding of the life. But you just hit it on the head again. His life is so difficult to get down. It has been trailed by so many distortions and mistruths, starting with everything that Wright did himself. He was a fantastic prevaricator, a distortionist, a fabulist of his own life. His 1932 autobiography, which I say is one of the great memoirs of the 20th century, even if you must distrust it on every page. I'm an old shoe leather journalist. I worked 30 years in daily journalism, most of it at the Washington Post. I was trying to take nothing at face value. Inadvertently, these mistakes get passed on through each generation, and Wright promulgated so many of them himself in his own lifetime. But the balancing act that you ask about between the egotist and the supreme architect, I tried to approach this with a fundamental respect, even if I needed to challenge every document that I could find at every turn. You know, Audrey, I don't spend 7 years trying to write about someone I don't like. You scrape everything away, all the refuse, all the dross of his ego and his arrogance, his incredible arrogance and his ego. I contend you scrape all that away. You cannot go away from looking at these buildings without appreciating there is a fundamental soulfulness at work. You could say that this book, in some ways, is a search for Frank Lloyd Wright's humanity. And I respectfully suggest that so many previous Wright chroniclers, historians, biographers have wished somehow to neglect that fundamental aspect of his humanity.
One thing that can't be denied is that he affected many people's lives, whether it was through his homes, his work. Of course, as you mentioned, his life was kind of surrounded in scandal at points with his personal life. He left his first wife and children. How do you balance those and take those into account?
It's so difficult to balance. All of his children suffered immeasurably at his hands. He had a total of 7 children, 6 by his first wife. All of them had extremely pain, difficult lives because of the psychic force of the father. He does this seeming unconscionable thing of abandoning his family and his children, the youngest of whom was just a little boy in 1909, just as his lover, Mema, who was his client, she abandoned her 2 children. So you would say, gee, you're making a case for this man's humanity when he does this. You know, you see things in his writings. He says, as if he's hanging himself with his own noose, he says, I've always had the father feeling for my building. I'm not sure I've ever had the father feeling for my children. I mean, how would that make you feel if you were a child of Frank Lloyd Wright and read that? No matter how, even if you had passed in your seventh decade at the time you read that, it doesn't matter. I've never quite had the father feeling for my own children. I do have the father feeling for my buildings. There's a lot you have to forgive in Frank Lloyd Wright. Yes, he built these grand prairie houses. He wanted the fame. He wanted the money. That was the route. That was early on. But there was a part of him, I believe, that always remained a small town boy with rural agrarian values who wanted to build shelter for the common man. Now, isn't that a decent and worthy impulse? That's why the vast bulk of his work is domestic. It's housing. It's not public monuments. It's not train stations. And this sense of wanting not only to build American architecture, but democratic American architecture, I think wanting to do that, you have to pollute it with all of his ego, and that he was building these buildings for himself, in a sense, for his own aesthetic particular purpose he was serving at that moment. Not all of it is mixed together. But I do feel that there's a worthy impulse that has to be looked at when you want to create dignified human shelters for ordinary Americans. What is not to admire there? What is not to defend there in terms of someone's humanity?
One thing you mentioned is that at heart he was a rural Wisconsin boy. And as you know, as people know, Wisconsin was his home. He built here, returned here. Even if he spent some time away doing projects, he always returned here. And you quote that he said, "Wisconsin soil has put the sap into my veins." So
isn't that beautiful? That's so beautiful.
It is. And you growing up not too far away from here, but I'm sure visiting his places here in Wisconsin. How have you found your visits here and seeing his work and connecting with him in that way? Do you look at his buildings and legacy differently now? And should we the next time we see one of his pieces of work?
I'm a native Midwesterner myself, having grown up in Kankakee, Illinois, and then later in the Illinois suburb. Chicago is sort of my hometown. He thought of himself as an old Madison boy. That's what he called himself at one point, an old Madison boy. Nothing made him happier than returning to those rounded bluffs near the Wisconsin River in southwestern Wisconsin, on that hillside of his Welsh forebears, those Lloyd Jones Valleys out in the Wyoming Valley and Helena Valley of Spring Green. No matter how widely worldwide he traveled, nothing made him happier than coming back. And I do feel you can get a sense of what he always preached. That is, that these works of his needed to kind of grow up from the ground itself. They had to come out of the ground searching for the light. And I think a Wisconsinite can take particular pride in that, and a Wisconsinite can get a particular feeling for what he means by that, that these works are indigenous to the land, the soil, the riverbank. It was as if they all grew up together in some long ago ice age. and they sprung right from the ground upon which they were built.
Well, Paul, I want to thank you for your time, not just today, but all of the time and dedication you have put into this work about Frank Lloyd Wright.
Thank you very much.
Paul Hendrickson is the author of Plagued by Fire, The Dreams and Furies of Frank Lloyd Wright. He spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski ahead of his event to talk about his book tonight at Boswell Book Company. You can find more information at WUWM.com. And that's all the time we have today. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you'll join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.